All right, welcome to The Nose. It's the end of our week here. And I think all of us, as we see some of the news that's unfolding this week, or some of us anyway, have said to ourselves, as I did today, the only thing that could possibly redeem the last 3 years of America and American life would be if Donald Trump were to pull off his mask and turn out to be Sacha Baron Cohen pulling a really long con on the American public. That's not what's happening, but both of those people have roles to play in our discussion this week, and that discussion will take place with Rebecca Castellani, scholar of modern literature and many other, and of Borat, as it turns out, as well. John Dankosky, executive editor of the New England News Collaborative and host of The Wheelhouse, and next on WNPR, Rich Holland, principal and design director at CoLab in Hartford. In our second segment today, we're going to talk about an HBO drama called Succession. Not a star-studded cast, although a very interesting cast, performing a very dark take on boardroom struggles, interfamily struggles, the lives of the one percenters of Manhattan. But before we do that, we're going to talk a little bit about protest and about ways in which art, comedy, performance are weaponized to try to express various levels of discontent right now with what feels at times like both moral and intellectual bankruptcy. But the guy who grabbed a lot of headlines this week is Sacha Baron Cohen. He also gets some of the most incredible free promotion I've ever seen in my life. He is launching a new series. He, of course, of Ali G, Borat, and Bruno. He's he has managed to fool people again. He's launching a new series on Showtime called Who is America? He has apparently fooled the likes of Dick Cheney and Sarah Palin with impersonations. And right away, they began protesting. And so first, I'm going to start over here with you, Rebecca, because you are apparently a scholar of Borat. And so, I mean, one thing we don't know, I mean, we barely know anything about this series except that everybody from Sheriff Joe Arpaio to Dick Cheney, everybody who got fooled, who got duped by Sacha Baron Cohen is now talking about him.
Yes. Roy Moore is suing multiple suits against Showtime. Showtime's been teasing this for a while, and people thought it was – the rumor was it was going to be a Kathy Griffin spot. They were teasing a brand new controversial comedy show, and everyone kind of assumed if it's controversial, it was going to be Kathy Griffin. I've been hoping that Sacha Baron Cohen was sitting away somewhere doing something like this because he's been alarmingly absent, and this is peak comedy. Because he was really, to me, exposing this – horrible underbelly of American racism before we had Trump as a president. I mean, there are some scenes in Borat. Borat's a hysterical movie, but are bone-chillingly real. And I think that I've been waiting for this moment for him to finally skewer all of this ridiculousness because it's just ripe for this kind of comedy. I mean, this is perfect for him. He loves getting these guys. Roy Moore said something like, this is Alabama doesn't appreciate dishonesty and bamboozlement and all this. It's like, well, exactly. I hope you understand how it feels now to be a citizen of this country, feeling like we've been bamboozled and duped and confused and lied to and manipulated. So I hope that he gets them all.
So John, Borat, Bruno, Ali G, Sacha Baron Cohen, they're all everything that NPR is kind of not, right? I mean, our whole thing is like, how much truth can we tell people? And his whole thing is about getting to a deeper truth using what some people might regard as slightly unethical means. Sarah Palin definitely thinks that these were unethical means.
Well, there's a couple different layers to this. As much as I enjoyed Borat and as much as I've enjoyed some of his work, I've always felt in comedy and in journalism, when you're punching down, it's worse than when you're punching up. And so I've never liked any comedy that takes on just the everyman and puts on a disguise and shows up at someone's backyard barbecue and skewers them. I don't mind trying to skewer Dick Cheney. That having been said, I mean, there are some questions about the way he went about the Sarah Palin interview specifically. If he was wearing different guises for different interviews, this is one which supposedly he shows up as a wounded American war veteran of some ilk. I don't think we've seen pictures yet, unless we have. I've not seen this. And it really does get on the leading edge of how far someone would go in order to get an interview, a fake interview or not, with a celebrity who probably wouldn't give an interview to any legitimate news source.
There's a lot of buts in there. And one of them specifically is, you know, there comes a point where you are a Dick Cheney and you are a Sarah Palin and you are a Donald Trump and, you know, and Stuttering John should not be able to get through to get to you. You know, that there's a whole vetting process of what's going on that, you know, that precludes this happening. I took a look at the letter that was sent to Sarah Palin, mm-hmm. you know, about this guy, some doctor from Truth. I can't even
Bill
say the
Wayne
world.
Ruddick Jr.
But
PhD.
What was it? It was Truth
from
Library.
Truth Library.
Yeah,
which is
like
amazing.
The collapse of truth and library, right? Yeah. And then, of course, I went to the website, right? Hmm. And if you check out this website, it's like it's a conspiracy theorist daydream. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all about how Hillary did it, et cetera. It played into absolutely everything that these people, in my mind, couldn't actually really believe
yes.
that it was a shtick that they were going with, and they dove in.
Yeah, if you look at the retweets that Sarah Palin retweets on a daily basis, and you actually dig in and look at the websites that she reads on a daily basis, there would be no reason to be surprised by that. She reads and consumes conspiracy theory material constantly.
Yeah.
This was very consistent in every way.
But I have seen her tweets, yeah. but, you know, and maybe it's just how far left I am that it's been so inconceivable that it's easier to believe that it's a big con than to believe that it's real.
Well, I mean, Sacha Baron Cohen, who delights in adding confusion to confusion to more confusion, is, among other things, claiming, I think in his letter to Sarah Palin, that he did not impersonate a wounded American military serviceman, but a United Parcel serviceman.
Yes.
I don't know whether that's a joke or whether that is anywhere in his actual charade. There are charades piled on top of charades. But, John, I'm going to just come back to you because, I mean, that's what I hear a little bit of what Rich is saying is also, or maybe I'll just say it, you know, conventional means don't seem to work very well. Alec Baldwin goes on week after week and does kind of a conventional Trump lampooning. It doesn't seem to matter. It doesn't seem to affect anything. I mean, as I was watching this whole thing unfold, I share some of your discomfort, but I was also thinking, well, nothing else seems to make any difference at all. Maybe you need somebody who's kind of unscrupulous, which might actually, you know, describe Sacha Baron Cohen.
But will this make any difference either? Mm-hmm. As it plays into even more of a national dialogue that sounds like a conspiracy theory on top of completely outlandish thing. I mean, look, at the end of the day, we also have to remember that there are pictures of Kid Rock standing in the Oval Office next to mm-hmm. the President of the United States. It's not as though it stops at Sacha Baron Cohen making fun of these people and trying to turn it into a different type of television program. President Trump's entire NATO trip has been an unveiling of things yeah. as though it was a season of a reality television yeah. show. There's no real difference. And so I don't know that I don't see the impact mm-hmm. that this type of comedy, as uncomfortable as it is, makes that's any different than the Alec Baldwin version of it.
So you send your toughest hockey goon out on the ice. It doesn't mean you're necessarily going to tip the scales and win the game. Although one of the interesting things, we were talking about this right before we went on, Rebecca. One of the things about Sacha Baron Cohen that I've always found fascinating is, you know, particularly through his Ali G character, he's often able to quickly expose the crabbiness or the uncooperativeness or the cluelessness of some famous person that he's interviewing. And their characteristics come out very quickly because he kind of quickly goads them into it by appearing to be this inept, easily dismissible, beratable person. Whereas Borat, who's, you know, really kind of horrifying in his own way, occasionally will call out the softer sides of Americans, too. That movie includes moments where Americans gently say, oh, no, you can't say things like that. You can't, you know, you can't treat women like that. And that's just not acceptable.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of wondering where he's going to go next. We're still talking about this thing that we haven't seen, which is frustrating. But
I mean, I think what we've kind of heard is there's multiple characters he's developed. So I think that it's going to enable him to kind of do both of those things he does so well. I mean, exactly as you said with Ali G, he thrives on making people uncomfortable to the point where they don't feel like there's that professionalism anymore and they can suddenly let the professionalism of themselves slip and you see the real person beneath. Whereas Borat almost was the opposite, where he was so affable and silly that you kind of felt bad for him, I think, and, and Americans pitied this, you know, this crazy outsider from Kazakhstan, wherever, and he doesn't know anything about conventional dining room customs. We can take a degree of pity on him, and then he catches them off guard.
But yeah, he's horrifically prejudiced against gypsies and Jews.
And exposes, you know, the people that go, I agree with you if we had our way in this country. You know, he's, he gets that camaraderie that then allows people to feel comfortable enough to expose themselves, and I think he's going to probably have to call on both those characters in one trope or another to, you know, expose different people that he's going after.
But that ends up being the fascinating thing to me about the people who are suing, right? It's not like he's walking around and injecting truth serum into them and you know, or playing the Mel Gibson line. It's like, well, you know,
he got
drunk. But, I mean, you know,
he
that's
got
who
you
are. You are presenting yourself. You know, no one is putting words in your mouth.
Yep.
You know, if someone is saying a racist thing and you feel a sort of freedom to one-up that, that's about you.
Right. You know? Like the people that call somebody out for, you know, swimming while black, and then suddenly they're all apologetic and always having a bad day. It's like, no, that's how you really
that's
are.
You
feel that way. So we might as well not sugarcoat this in retrospect.
And I think the other piece to add to that, to Colin's statement about that, he draws out, you know, through his, you know, screwballness, draws out, you know, pieces of warmth and compassion from people. And maybe I've just become cynical in my old age, right? When you show your bad side, I accept that as your bad side. You know, when you show your really good side, you know, I'm going to hang in a little longer to see if that holds together.
What were you going to say, John?
No, I think that the issue, and the reason I bring up, again, Kid Rock in the Oval Office, Sarah Palin doing conspiracy theories constantly, is so now we'll hear Dick Cheney or Roy Moore saying something that we probably already have heard them say in public in a speech already. That's the problem, I think, at the base of this question of how do you lampoon the current moment in society when everything is right out there already? You're not going to get anything different.
Yeah.
We have a president of the United States who literally says something in the morning and says, I didn't say it later in the day. It's really hard to say, well, hell, now we got him. Now we got Dick Cheney signing a waterboarding kit. Yeah. That's going to tell us something new about Dick Cheney.
Yeah, he does apparently autograph some waterboarding equipment. Well, Rich, let me give you the opportunity to play the role of James Hanley here today. Because if James were here, I think he might be pointing out that, you know, one of the things about the moment that we're in right now and all of the ways that it's frightening and disturbing is it's eminently monetizable by everybody. I mean, Showtime is launching what they hope is going to be a hit Sacha Baron Cohen series this weekend. I mean, there's a way in which a lot of people make out, and not just on one side.
Well, and I think that this is also going to dovetail into our next segment, you know, around what sells right now. I don't believe that HBO cares one way or the other about the moral fiber or the ethical fiber of what they're putting out there. I think they're banking on, you know, on what's going to work, and it's going to lean into what worked before, and we're going to take it one step forward to see if that one step forward does any better. I think it's all about commerce. There is a great tragedy in that, I believe, and it's a creative tragedy in that business people are walking around considering themselves artists right now, and there's a bit of a concern to that, and as part of my recommendation today, I'm going to be talking about this book called The Treason of the Intellectuals. And it was all about the point in which the creative folks decided to cash in the response that they had, that they are called to have to society, and give the people what the people want in order to, you know, to monetize on that. And it's created a tremendous amount of disarray in our society, and I think that we're seeing it now.
Well, I want to throw it back to the maybe the biggest believer here at the table in the work of Sacha Baron Cohen.
I believe in Borat.
So I mean, you know, the argument that Rich is making and the book is making, it's a familiar one. Theodore Razak made it years ago, that it's hard to have a counterculture that doesn't get pretty quickly co-opted by the main culture. I don't know. Can Sasha keep himself pure?
I don't know. I mean, I think that the other thing we have to keep in mind here is we've turned into a really rapid meme culture where something will suddenly be really funny and you see it everywhere. There's the latest one with a baby picture of Cardi B, and now it's on dealerships across America. People are trying to sell cars using Cardi B's image. We dispose of this content so quickly and consume it so quickly that I do worry that the Borat who he, Sacha Baron Cohen was, the Ali G, that model might not work as well as it did. But I think he's smart enough to know that. I think we haven't seen him for a while because he's probably being very thoughtful about this. So I'm going into it very hopeful. That
it's
this
a long project. He's talking about this
long.
This is a year project, and it's a very long con. And that takes some time. That's not too disposable.
So I like to think he realizes he's got to kind of adapt his model from pre-Trump to the post-Trump world.
John, it does seem, and this will sort of segue a little bit more into what Rich was wanting to talk about, as Trump goes other places, you see images being weaponized in interesting ways. There's very familiar baby balloon that was flying in London today. And I was fascinated this week because, and I'm going to you because I know music of this era either irritates you profoundly or inspires you profoundly. And I think I know which one this song does. But in order to prepare Britain for Trump's arrival, some of his detractors actually worked to get the song American Idiot by Green Day to be the number one song. And this is an old song, but you can bomb an algorithm pretty easily these days. So they worked hard on it. I don't know. What do you make of something like that?
Well, first of all, it's a very British way of protesting, which I like. But I'll say that there's a more global way of protesting that we're just seeing today, as a matter of fact. About 250,000 people on the streets of London holding signs, not unlike the signs that people were holding in Washington and New York and many other cities, including Hartford around the country, on a series of protests that have happened over the course of the last year and a half or so. And I think that, you know, the baby balloon notwithstanding, that gets an awful lot of attention because it's big and it's kind of funny to look at. What you're really seeing is hundreds of thousands of people carrying signs, some of which say very, very funny things, some of which are artistically very thoughtful, and some of them are very crude and probably aren't all that thoughtful. But it's just the idea of everyone getting together in this way that I have not seen in my lifetime, truly. And there's something that's feeling new and fresh about that, because it's about 50 years on since the last time we saw big groups of people doing that, and it's just a little bit older than me.
My countdown clock is running before PepsiCo is sponsoring one of these protests.
Well, okay, but talk about that. I mean, so and that clearly bothers you.
That's the big issue that I'm having, John, is that I don't know if it bothers me. If it leads to social change, then it doesn't bother me. But if what it does is it anesthetizes us, then we've got a problem because we're running out of opportunities for change other than violence.
Well, I want to go back to the point you were making before too, Rich, which is that the distinction between merch and protest gets very thin at a certain point. You were saying that friends of yours who are antagonists of Trump were hoping that there would be kind of a desktop version
of
the baby balloon. And talk about these. I didn't even know about this till you emailed us about it through a third-party vendor that's using the Walmart website.
Oh, this is fabulous. It's football jerseys, specifically football jerseys, which I think is hilarious. They are selling at Walmart Impeach 45.
It's the number 45,
it's a jersey number 45, and the player name would be Impeach. So you're walking around with an Impeach 45 shirt that you could buy at Walmart.
And there's a onesie, too, for your baby.
Really? I didn't know that. That's awesome. Makes you want to have a child.
Well, people were calling to boycott Walmart, and then the other side was saying, well, they sell MAGA apparel at Walmart, too. So what's so bad about this? We should be fair and balanced with Walmart's selling of merchandise.
Yeah, and to Rich's point, yes, everyone will make a dollar off of all of these things. Yes. I mean, people will buy those shirts. People will buy Colin Kaepernick jerseys. People will buy MAGA hats at the same place. Everyone seems to make a little something off of this, and that truly is different than the last time we saw mass movements of protest. So maybe it doesn't feel as much like a protest. Yeah. It's just people getting together and taking pictures of themselves and putting them on Instagram.
And to get back to the question that you were asking me about whether this is good or not, is we now have a model where we can monetize Discord. You know, that there's value in Discord and we could put money to it. Mm. You know, I'm just curious if monetizing unification will have more benefit. You know, will be worth more.
I think there's no money in unification.
I don't think so.
I mean, I think we've been monetizing Discord for a long time, having worked for 16 years at a radio station where I either preceded immediately or followed Rush Limbaugh. After a while, I started to realize, boy, if everybody gets along, he's got no act. You know, if people could manage their differences at all, He's got no shtick whatsoever. He's out of business. But, I mean, there doesn't seem to be any danger of that, and he's certainly creating new customers any way he can every day.
Is there a reason – you talked about this last week, Colin, but is there a reason why we're fascinated by Fred Rogers now? Why we have a movie in which people go and think about and talk about someone from their childhood who actually throughout his entire life and career preached the idea that we should get along, we could understand others, we can be nice, and that's kind of a punk rock thing to do?
Although, are we fascinated enough by Fred Rogers?
Yeah, I want to see how it does.
Yeah. All right. Why don't we take a break here? That'll give us some time to have a conversation about this HBO series, which I think we're not in unanimity about. So that'll be interesting and fun, too, after this. Don't want to be an American idiot. Don't want a nation under the new media. And can you hear the sound of hysteria? The subliminal mind of America. All right, we are back. When I say we, I mean Rebecca Castellani, John Dankosky, and Rich Holland are here doing the nose, our weekly cultural roundtable. We're now going to talk about a series that I confess that I've gotten hooked on HBO, and I know other people who've gotten hooked on it and don't necessarily feel good about it. It tells the story of the Roy family, R-O-Y. I think this is meant to evoke Rob Roy a little bit because they're Scottish, but also the word R-O-I, I think, which is French for king. This is about a aging lion of a huge media empire, a little bit Rupert Murdoch, a little bit William Randolph Hearst. He is sick. It's a sort of questionable or doubtful or debatable how sick he actually is. Just before we get going here, I'll just play a little clip for you. Logan Roy is played by the great Brian Cox. He's been rushed to the hospital with a cerebral bleed that the family believes he might not survive. Here are his four children, Kendall, Roman, Siobhan, better known as Shiv, and Connor, fighting over who should run the company, with the body, of course, still quite warm.
Look, the board are offering this to me. I don't actually need your backing.
Yeah. You actually really I totally think you do. Yeah.
Without it, after what Dad did to you, I mean, we could probably take any appointment to court.
Jesus, Shiv, we're talking about court now?
You! You know, I didn't even want to talk about this, remember?
Look, what do you have against me?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Oh, you want me to actually say?
Yes, I do.
You lack killer instinct, you're wet, you're green, you're intellectually insecure, you're not emotionally enough, you have addiction issues.
That's enough.
I don't think all that, I'm just trying to be Dad's voice.
Bravo, that's an excellent impression.
I just want to say, I'm not getting involved.
Good.
But Shiv's right. I'm not saying I would make a better CEO, that's unsaid.
It's not unsaid when you say it.
No, I'm saying I'm not saying it, so in fact it is unsaid.
Hey pal, why don't you go help Willow with her homework?
Ouch. Listen, why don't you decide everything? I don't care. I just observe. I'm a UN white helmet. All right?
You get a little bit of a sense of the way people talk in this series. It is about, as we say, people battling for control of a big media empire. It's produced by Frank Rich, who also produced Veep. I don't think that's a coincidence. And in fact, one of the other contributors to it. Well, I think sort of the creative driving force behind it is somebody else who's worked on other Armando Iannucci projects. So, Rebecca, I'm going to start with you. Just in general, what did you make of this?
So, at first blush, I was not very interested. My partner started watching it, and I kind of was in and out of the room. I said, this sounds awful. I get enough of this just through the regular media. I don't want to watch a bunch of white people arguing over really a lot of money. And then when I watched a second episode, I said, you know what, this actually seems a little bit more worthy of my interest than I initially thought. So I sat back down and watched the whole thing. And I found that the more time I spent with these characters, the more I understood what the show was trying to do and the more I enjoyed it. I think it is a good show. I don't think it's necessarily a very enjoyable show. I don't think it's necessarily very innovative. I do think there is an argument that there's a certain catharsis one can achieve by dealing with a show like this. So on the whole, I do think I will continue watching it. I don't know if it's watching from a place of relaxation or happiness.
So you don't look for – first of all, you're doing it kind of more millennial style. You're not, like, waiting for it to drop on Sunday nights. And, you know.
Yeah, well, I did. And that's kind of a point that I want to make to the effect of this Netflix and HBO model is – that I do find now that I've had to wait a week and I've watched it, I enjoyed it even more because I've had a week to ruminate on it, where something that you binge on Netflix is designed for mass, fast consumption, where this is really, I think, intended to be watched with a week in between, kind of like Westworld, where you really need almost 2 weeks to wrap your head around what happens in the previous episode.
And even that's not really enough time.
You need a Reddit forum. You need a panel of investigators helping you figure it out. So this definitely, I think, should be consumed on an episodic basis weekly.
All right. John, how about you?
Well, here's the thing. It's hard to like any of the characters in this, and in part, it's because they live in a world that most of us, almost all of us, don't live in, and they act as terribly as possible while within that world, and that becomes very obvious in the first episode. I as I watched more and more into it, I've not watched all the episodes yet, but I've watched five into it, and I like it more as I go because you get to know the characters and you get to understand the world in which they live a little bit better so that you can admire some pieces of the writing. The problem is this program, more than any other series that HBO has done recently or Netflix, the first episode does not do anything for me. It actually gets it off to a very poor start because the characters are so incredibly unlikable and do such horrific things to each other, say such awful things to people who, again, to the point of punching down versus punching up, who are beneath them in the hierarchy. It's really hard to watch. And so in that way, I don't know, it felt like the anti-HBO show because I love the HBO shows that are The Sopranos and Boardwalk Empire. These are flawed characters that I can love and hate. I was just hating these people. And it's hard for me five episodes in to stop hating them enough to love anyone.
Let me just ask you one follow-up question about that, though. I mean, one could argue this is the ultimate punching up series in the sense that our disdain and the whatever disdain the creators have for this family is necessarily upward punching. They are fractions of one percenters.
Yes. One of the problems with anything that deals with the type of uber wealth and privilege that this series deals with is that no matter how terrible people's lives are, no matter how fractured and awful they seem to one another, you still get the sense that they get to get in helicopters and limousines and have other people take care of them the rest of the time. And so many people in America actually would like just a fraction of that, could use just a little tiny bit of someone taking care of them on a daily basis and putting up with their crap if they talk badly to them. And that's what's awful, that there's even the sense that we have room for people like this in our society nauseates me probably more than it should.
You haven't, I don't think, gotten to the episode six, the most recent one, but there's a way in which that whole helicopter thing comes back to bite one of them in the butt in a very interesting way. But anyway, Rich.
That helicopter thing, I'm going to get to that in a second. So to a certain extent, I kind of have been enjoying one piece of this, I'm getting to watch a bunch of really rich white people cannibalize each other, which gives the rest of us an opportunity for a bathroom break. These are despicable people, and they're despicable to the point of caricature. I was curious how good the performances were going to have to be over time, which is what had me hanging in there, to see how good the performances had to be for me to actually want to hang in with despicable people that are caricatures. And so far, they're pretty interesting. The part that's got me hanging in is I have had none of those aspirations that you were talking about, John. The aspirations of having folks take care of me or any of that stuff, you know? I just, you know, would like to have a couple of tender moments every now and then. You know, that would work for me just fine.
Although, I don't know.
So I take a look at how these folks are living, and it's going into a new culture in a thing that I had no idea about. This helicopter scene, you know, is to me, the what the show is really about. That these folks are sitting around the table and they cannot connect unless they are playing a game, you know, and that game is played with incredibly outrageous stakes that I don't understand why those stakes have that much meaning. You know, it's not that I don't understand high stakes. It's like, why does this matter for crying out loud? You know, so they fly to like this island to play? Were they playing baseball? I don't even know
they're
what
playing,
they're
playing. Yeah, they're playing
the game.
And the island was Long Island, yeah. Just to make it even like more loaded that they took a helicopter to Long Island and they could take a ferry or anything else.
Three helicopters flying through the city.
Rich, I do want to say we send a limo to pick up Rebecca every time, and I've always said that you don't want that.
I don't want. Thank you. Can I tell you a quick story?
Yeah.
When I first met my current wife, I had just fallen and basically snapped both my wrists, so I was in a cast. And we were going to go out to the theater, right? And the only way that I knew how to get about, because I was thinking like this chauvinist idiot, was that she couldn't possibly drive us there, was that that I rented a limo. And I told her, like, oh, no, I've got it covered. We've got a ride. And she sat me down, and this was early in our relationship, said, I'd love for this relationship to go somewhere, but this kind of nonsense is going to kill it. Right? So I really don't buy into it.
Yeah, I know. And again, just to be clear, I'm not saying that that's an aspiration that I have or that people think about, oh, my God, I wish I could ride in a limo. It's just that whenever you try to lampoon the 1% or the top 0.1%, there's always this sense that for them, the stakes are all just made up. It's about whether or not my father likes me. It's about whether or not I'm going to get this position in the company versus another position. But you will still have millions of dollars to fall back on if you wanted to pursue your life as a painter. And that's the part that separates, obviously, the lives of the rich and famous from the rest. This isn't the first time anyone has tried to present the lives of the rich and famous to us.
Yeah.
It is interesting that because in some ways they're lampooning the Murdochs, in some ways they're obviously lampooning the Trumps, it's coming to a forefront, and this maybe just isn't the world that I want to see right now.
Hmm. So one of the things we talked about as we were emailing about this, Rebecca, was I said that one of my first reactions to this is it really did seem like a pretty conscious attempt to create something that was Shakespearean without being Shakespeare specific. There's a way in which Logan Roy, the Brian Cox character, is King Lear, although he has more sons than he has daughters. But there's also lots of other ways in which the power struggles here do resemble some of the power struggles we see in Shakespeare. Maybe the thing that's missing, and this goes to points that I guess John and Rich are kind of making, is that even with Macbeth, we see somebody who is uncertain of how he got to the point that he was at. Was he always this kind of horrible person, or did fate manipulate him into this position? And he does struggle a bit. We don't see too much of those kinds of compunctions among these people, but I don't know. Does this ascend to that level for you at all?
I mean, it certainly doesn't ascend to the level of Shakespeare, but it has Shakespearean elements to it for sure. I think that this idea that Logan Roy, I mean, he's got no real love for his children, and I think that's right to your point that he doesn't love them because they've already been at this position. There has been no—you can't really imagine Roman Roy, who's the third youngest son, ever being a good, nice, giving, loving person when he's been growing up being shuttled around to for a casual baseball game on Long Island in a helicopter. He didn't really have that opportunity, I think, to cut his teeth on being a hardworking, good human being. And I think that's why the father is so resentful of his children and so unwilling to turn over the kingdom. And I think that that's kind of where most of the tension for me arises, because the children, despite all this, are very hungry for their father's love and approval and the love and approval of each other. And I think that's one of the more redeeming qualities to it, is that take all the money out, take all this. This is a family drama and a family struggle.
But Roman wants love and approval of two guys on the elevator. I mean, this
guy's
just— Yeah,
but I think
lost.
That's because he doesn't have anything real, and that's the only thing he understands. But I think if you psychoanalyze that, it's really due to the fact that he doesn't have a mommy and a daddy who love him.
So I wanted to quickly mention that these adult children are played by, for the most part, a quartet of actors we don't know particularly well. Jeremy Strong plays the oldest son, Kendall, the one who's making the biggest move on his father's empire. We also meet Kieran Culkin as Roman, who's kind of a dissipated Mercutio, less charming than Mercutio type, who sometimes manages to tell uncomfortable truths. There's also a daughter, Siobhan, played by an actress named Sarah Snook. You can tell I'm mentioning people that you don't see a lot. And who am I forgetting? There's like a fourth son that we don't see very often, who's kind of dropped out of the whole process here. But there's also kind of this, Shakespeare sometimes will have these kind of rude mechanicals, the ones who speak in prose rather than in verse. And this doesn't really have this, but it has kind of a second tier, Rich, and it's some of the people who are a little bit outside the circuit of power. And I'm thinking in particular of Tom, played by Matthew McFadden. He is this unctuous would-be fiancé of the daughter, desperately approval-seeking, handed things that he's really not capable of managing. And then this guy who seems to be fascinating all of us, a younger guy named Greg, a somewhat distant relation of the family, the grandson of Logan's brother, who has no money and is trying to insert himself somehow through some combination of affability and clueless compliance that seems to mask maybe a little bit more deviousness than he initially lets on. I'm going to just play a little scene between the two of them. Tom has been placed in control of a division. He's discovered that there are things going on in that division that are troubling. And knowing about these things is also troubling. And so he brings in his clueless new relation, Greg, to talk about this.
It seems I have been exposed to a virus.
Oh, right.
Yeah. It's a deadly virus, and now, forever.
It sounds bad.
It is bad. It is. And I kind of need to share it, but anyone I talk to, I effectively kill. That's the death pit, Greg. Take a look.
I mean, I feel like I might not like it in the death pit.
Go ahead. Your family.
Richard, there's a way in which some of this is comedy. Some of this is played for comedy. I don't know how much of it's comedy, but often with those kinds of scenes, like the one between Tom and Greg, I'm laughing.
I think it's always more interesting to pay attention to the pilot fish, right? Because what do they have to work with? You know, they have the scraps to work with. So those characters are phenomenal. Mm-hmm. My question is, can you make a movie with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern? Yeah, you can. You know, and there was a great one that was done, but I don't think that these folks are being utilized yet to that way. But I do certainly see that they have possibly the most at risk here and the most to gain. So I'm waiting to see how they play out.
It's almost like they're setting up a buddy comedy spinoff of Tom and Greg, where they just get up to capers and destroy documents together and evade the FBI.
I mean, John, does any of this work for you as comedy?
Well, I think actually a lot of those two characters work as comedy. I think that there's an awful lot that's funny in the show. I think that the character of Greg, who's meant to be comic relief and clearly takes on more of a serious role throughout the course of the episodes, is just so unbelievable a character that he, despite whatever family ties he has, would get so close to the seat of power of such a large media empire, shows that, in essence, this has to be a comedy. This has to be a farce. It can't be something we take seriously as a portrait of what corporate America, even family corporate America, might look like, because it's just not realistic. And that's my problem with it. There's funny stuff in there. It's just that it's funny to a point, and then I think I can't again care about the characters enough because it doesn't seem like a real thing, and it's not enough of a comedy to make me laugh all the time.
I really wonder if there's something about that degree of wealth that I just don't understand, right? Because I would expect that degree of wealth, that there would be a lot of holding court that's taking place. But maybe that happens a step lower.
I think so.
You know, that at this degree of court, there is no holding.
Well, yeah. One thing I want to close by just bringing this up. I've seen a lot of things recently that violate what I always thought was kind of the basic principle of all ensemble work, which is that there does have to be some kind of sympathetic point of entry, you know, that you can do the Mary Tyler Moore Show, but you can't do it without Mary Tyler Moore. You can't just have all these other dysfunctional people who work at the TV station. You need somebody for us to identify with as you meet a bunch of other quirky and sometimes a little bit sociopathic characters. But increasingly, on Veep, Rebecca, There's nobody who isn't cynical, disgusting, and dysfunctional. The same goes for this. You could kind of say that about Ozark. I mentioned this because Jason Bateman just got an Emmy nomination today for his fabulous work as Marty Bird, the somewhat sociopathic protagonist of that. It used to be that you couldn't sustain interest, and you probably can't sustain John Dankosky's interest indefinitely if you have a bunch of characters where there isn't that place to land. There's no place to land where you can go, oh, this is me. This is me gazing, you know, in a basically emotionally and ethically neutral or maybe even good-hearted way at all these bad-hearted people. But I wonder if we're maybe living in times where this kind of just works better.
I think that this is the reality. I don't think there is the entry point in the 1% of the 1%. I don't think there is, you know, a Trump child, maybe, I can't even remember her name. See, there you go. She's not even on the radar. The younger
Tiffany?
Trump. Tiffany Trump. Like, even Tiffany Trump is not anywhere near someone we can relate to or entry with. So I think that that's very intentional. You're not really supposed to have anyone besides maybe Cousin Greg, who's coming at it as an outsider and trying to just wade his way through all of the social conduct and information that he shouldn't really have access to, but now finds himself in the middle of.
I just really quickly want to say I'm really glad you mentioned Ozark, though. Mm. It's a show I watched 3 episodes of. Just couldn't. I couldn't do it anymore because I didn't like the people.
I love Ozark.
Yeah.
and I watched it all the way through. And I think that the huge difference between these stories is the family's struggle and their desire to really hold together and that there is love there. You know, he had 2 sets of decisions to make, right? This growing sort of scheming aspect of himself, but he also had decisions to make about his family, and he struggled. This movie, I'm seeing nobody struggling with anything but their egos.
Rich, I think another difference is, I mean, one of the things that characterizes Succession from the very beginning is this both interior and exterior, and I'm talking about the sets, sense of chilliness, right? It's cold. It's cold outside. They go to play this game in a very cold environment. The interiors are cold, too. I'm talking to you right now because you're the design guy here, you know? But there's a way in which, I mean, Ozark is kind of lush and organic. Mm-hmm. And there's, like, stuff just sprouting out of everywhere in this kind of warm, moist climate. And I think it's not insignificant, and I think it bears on the stuff you're talking about.
And some of the stuff that happens in a thing like Ozark are completely accidental. Nature plays a part in outcomes. Here, none of that is happening. It's all calculated and intentional and maniacal. It's chess
and
on 3 stages.
When something does happen that's beyond the character's control, they think so purely that they can control it. Mm-hmm. And then that frustration of coming against all the money in the world can't stop. If the FAA says you can't fly an airplane, you can't fly an airplane. I mean, that...
John doesn't know yet.
Sorry, John. All right. It's not a huge spoiler.
Yeah, no. We have to take a break right now, so we'll have time for recommendations. We'll do that. We'll be back.
I'd like to point out that the Emmys now have a category called Outstanding Structured Reality Program. Aren't we all living in a structured reality program these days? Just not an outstanding one. Today's structured reality program was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Amanda Fish is swimming the English Channel. I just realized I don't get the English Channel on my cable package. The part of Bill Curry was played by Brian Cox. We'll be back on Monday with a look at the weekend's news. And now, back to Colin.
Time to make some recommendations. We'll start over here with Rebecca Castellani.
So for the first time yesterday, I went to the No Good Market in Hartford and had a great time. So I highly, highly recommend checking that out. The next one is August 9th. It's on Bartholomew Street in Hartford.
Rich is a big supporter.
Yeah, it's fabulous. Bunch of great food, music,
it's food
vendors.
Trucks in particular,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, a lot of food trucks. There was a great cocktail truck. There's a couple jewelers, some local vintage sellers. It was fabulous. Yeah. So highly recommend that. And then if you're looking for another bleak television series, because I know I just love to take all of this in and cry in my room, The Handmaid's Tale season 2 was really good. I know that a lot of people don't feel the same way, but I really loved it. I thought in particular, I can never pronounce her last name, so I'm not going to try, but Serena Joy, the actress Yvonne Strahovski, I think, it was just knocked it out of the park this season, so I would recommend that.
I will totally agree. I think the second season was excellent. I just have two quick endorsements here. One is for one of my favorite musicians who's actually reimagined one of my all-time favorite records. Back in 1980, the Talking Heads' Remain in Light was groundbreaking, and it was groundbreaking in large part because they adopted the sounds and the textures of West African music, and they, in many people's minds, appropriated them in some ways very appropriately, in some ways not so appropriately, but they made a masterpiece of rock and Afrobeat. And Angélique Kidjo, who is a brilliant vocalist, has reimagined this record in her own way. And so just hearing Remain in Light in a new light so many years later is really, really worthwhile, and I highly recommend it. And my second recommendation very quickly is kittens. If anybody has been following me on social media, you've seen that I've just recently adopted two newborn kittens who were basically they were left on our doorstep. One of the siblings had already perished, and the two were malnourished. And over the course of the last couple of weeks, spending more time with kittens actually makes you think about the rest of the world in a much different way. And I think it's one of the reasons why maybe I don't like Succession so much, because the people there are terrible.
Because the kittens don't like
but the kittens.
Kittens
are not.
But kittens are awesome. So anyway, I just highly recommend kittens.
Yeah, never watched an HBO series you couldn't justify to kittens.
I have two recommendations, one I already made. Read Treason of the Intellectuals, and then reevaluate everything that you consume. Next, I'm going to recommend a piece of music. Download Joan Armatrading album. It's black feminist liberation the way it was intended to be. It's not at all about proclaiming. It's about presenting what it means to be free.
I'm going to recommend, I'll do another, it's not exactly bleak, and certainly it falls into the kind of warmer or more organic style of Ozark, except it's more L.A. noir. It's the series on Amazon Prime called Goliath. In particular, I just finished the second season. Now, let me just say this. The other person in the house felt that the second season of Goliath, which stars Billy Bob Thornton and Nina Arianda, a wonderful actress whom you mainly get to see on stage. She sort of won a hands-down Tony a few years ago for her performance in Venus and Fur. But she's really terrific. It's fun to see her on the screen. This is L.A. Noir, and Billy Bob Thornton can, of course, excel anybody on Succession in dissipation. Nobody does dissipation the way Billy Bob does. I don't know. The second season also has a fantastically weird, quirky performance. Is There Any Other Kind by Mark Duplass? But it is a little bit like James Ellroy and David Lynch got together to make something. So if that would bother you, then don't watch it, because it does get a little freaky at times. And then the other thing I'm going to recommend is more of a philosophical nature. So the last couple of weeks, I've been going through a little bit of some health problems that turned out fine, but it sort of brought me to mind, or brought into my mind, the fact that when you go through something like this, when you go through anything that kind of reminds you that we're just, you know, renting space here on Earth, you think about all the things that you haven't done. And I feel like I've been a very lucky person. I've got to do a lot of the things that I want to do. But I'm just going to sort of remind all of you as you head into the weekend, as you head into the rest of your summer, as you head into the rest of the year, if there's something, you know, taking voice lessons or going to Japan or learning to roller skate, if there's something that you absolutely intend to get around to doing that would make you feel more complete, maybe taking voice lessons in Japan while you're on roller skates. I don't know what it is. Do it. Just go and do it. Do those things that will make you feel more whole and complete. And do them now, because, you know, it's like a carpe diem kind of thing. Not necessarily a big revelation or a new philosophy, but I got a big reminder of that. I also got reminded how many really wonderful friends that I have. I'm lucky to be living with a wonderful woman who has really helped me go through this. And Jim Chapdelaine, also of The Nose, is one of those guys that you just pick up the phone and call if you're going through anything. So anyway, it was a little bit scary. It turned out to be all good news. I'm going to tell the story of it at some point when I can figure out how to tell that story. But the main thing I want to leave you guys with is that notion anyway. If there's something that would make you feel more complete, make your life feel more complete, you should do it right now. And to that point, and Wolfie, if the music's ready, you can bring it up. Last night down at the Kate in Old Saybrook, Jill Sobule, who's been a regular visitor to the show, was performing. This is a song of hers about that whole idea of not waiting too long to do stuff. Thank you.
Yeah. gonna get it together. Gonna be on time, I'm gonna get it together. Stop wasting time. And one of these days I'll accept the fact I'm not getting any younger and I can't go back. Can't go back. And one of these days when I fall in love, it won't fall.